Breakfast at Sally's by Richard Lemieux. Chapter 32. The Holy Ghost.
I have no place to go, she said, beginning to cry again. I don't know what to do.
She put her face against my shoulder as a fresh wave of sobs shook her body. Again, I just held her and let her cry. Again, I tried to think of what I could do to help her. When she eventually became quiet, I said, Well, it's already about midnight. I don't think there is much we can do until morning. But I do think maybe this place has enough room for one more church mouse. She pulled her head back off my shoulder.
You mean I could stay here?
She asked. You will even have your own room, I said. The youth room downstairs has a big couch and some blankets and an afghan to keep you warm. Then you'll have to get up in the morning and talk to the pastor here. He comes in about 8:30. I know he will help you.
I don't want to cause you any trouble, she said. I don't want to be a burden to anybody. It seems like I've always been a burden to my dad.
You're no trouble, I said, giving her another quick hug and then helping her to her feet. You are not a burden, I assured her. I asked her if she was hungry, and she admitted that she was. Well, come with me, I said. I know where there are some delicious sandwiches and some cupcakes and milk. I escorted her to the kitchen, found her a towel, and directed her to the sink, then pilfered 4 more sandwiches and 2 cupcakes and poured her a big glass of milk. I knew that I would be forgiven for my thievery. I set everything on the long kitchen table and pulled up a stool for her across the table from mine. My name is Richard, I said, realizing that I hadn't told her that before.
I'm Michelle,
she said, accepting the place at the table. She took a bite of her sandwich and then looked at me more closely.
You know, I've seen you before. You came through the drive-thru at McDonald's one day and got a hamburger for your dog. I work there, at the one just up the street.
Probably us, I said. Willow loves McDonald's hamburgers.
I'm trying to save up to get a car, she continued between bites. Then I can get away from my father and leave this town. I'm 18.
She took a drink of her milk.
Do you have any children?
No. I lied, looking away from her. I didn't want to think or talk about my children at the moment.
That's too bad, the girl said. You would be a good father, not like my dad.
Well, Michelle, I think fathers always love their children, I said. Sometimes things go wrong, times can be tough, but deep down inside, love is there. He's probably out looking for you right now.
Not my dad,
she said very firmly.
There is no love in him. He's just mad and drunk.
Well, let's get some sleep. Things may be better in the morning, I replied. You look tired.
I am, she agreed, and I've got to get to work early in the morning. I can't miss any more time or they'll fire me. I have to be there at 6.
Okay, I said. But do try to come by and see the pastor after you get off. Maybe he can help you.
Okay, I will,
she said, finishing off her milk. I could see that she was feeling better, as well as getting sleepy. Follow me, and I'll show you your quarters for the night. I stood up and opened the kitchen door. We walked downstairs. I turned on the light to the youth room and showed her the couch. She stretched out on it immediately.
I'm so tired, she said.
I took one of the blankets and gently placed it over her, and then placed the afghan over that. That should keep you warm, I said, and don't be afraid if you hear noises. It's just the furnace grumbling and the water running through the old pipes. I'll leave this light on for you, I added, flipping the wall switch for the lighted stained glass display on the wall. Then I turned off the other lights.
That's so beautiful, she said.
It is, isn't it? I replied. Well, I'll be upstairs sleeping in the sanctuary. Good night.
Richard,
she called out as I began to close the door.
Would you pray for me?
Sure, I said, and closed the door gently. As I climbed back up the stairs, I wondered if I had done the right thing. Would I face trouble in the morning and be kicked out of the church? I had no permission to do what I had done. Well, I didn't care. I had done the only thing I could do, and it felt right. I got my sleeping bag out from behind the pew, unrolled it on the scarlet carpet, and climbed in. Willow was right behind me. The old church that had been filled earlier that evening with so many happy people, singing, partying, and sharing their stories, was now quiet. I crossed my arms behind my head and replayed the sounds of the songs that the choir had been practicing. "Oh, holy night," I started to sing, but I couldn't remember the words, so I lapsed into humming. Then I began softly to sing a song that I did remember. "Silent night, holy night, all is calm, all is bright." Willow had fallen asleep. I rolled over, closed my eyes, and smiled to myself. I had learned that song when I was 6 years old. Though I was tired, the building was not. It seemed to be creaking even more than usual. But it wasn't long before I accepted its sounds as natural. The furnace must be running a little more because it was cold outside. I was glad to be inside. I was happy Michelle was inside as well, rather than walking in the cold streets all alone. Then I remember what she had asked me to do. What good is it going to do for me, who does not believe, to pray for her? I wondered. But I had said I would. So I closed my eyes and said a few words into the silence. "Dear God, please watch over Michelle and keep her safe. Thank you for having a place where she could come and have shelter for this night." There, I did it. I said a prayer just as Michelle asked. Short, but not a bad prayer for a non-believer, I thought. Then, lying there in the dim light, I began thinking of my own daughter. Her name was Michelle, too. I guess I really had two visitors this night, the girl downstairs and the daughter here in my memory. How strange that they had the same name. I felt guilty for my deceit to the one downstairs, saying I didn't have any children. I felt even worse knowing that I was denying the existence of my children. My Michelle was about 28 now, I thought. I wasn't exactly sure. She had tried to help me when I had first lost everything. She let me sleep on her couch a few times and gave me what she could from her savings. $5 here, $10 there. She even gave me $200 that she had received as a gift. But she had a small house, and her husband didn't want me sleeping there. I remembered the last time I pulled into her driveway. She was feeding her two horses, and she looked up at the sound of my car. I could see a look in her eyes I had never seen there before. I knew in that instant that I had become a burden, an unwelcome guest. I was no longer wanted. I was a nuisance. It was 3 weeks before Christmas, and I had come to ask if I could sleep on her couch and borrow a few dollars again. But I could tell from her body language that she would not help this time. "Dad," she said, "if you've come here to ask for help again, I can't." Her voice was cracking. "I just don't have any money." "I understand," I said. "I know this is hard for you. It's just that, well, I don't have any place to go."
"I'm sorry, Dad, but I can't have you here."
I walked over her and hugged her tight. "I know," I said. "It's okay. I'll find somewhere else. I love you."
"Love you too,"
Michelle said quietly, hugging me in return. I walked back to the van. She looked at the ground. I got in and pulled away. As I drove down the road, I felt a profound emptiness. I knew that I couldn't expect my daughter to understand my depression. I didn't understand it myself. If it was something that could be seen, like cancer, it might have been different for her. It must be hard for her to see me, her dad, like this. I had always been so strong, so confident, so full of life. Now her dad was a bum, looking for a handout and a couch to sleep on. I promised myself that I would always love my daughter, but I knew I could not go back there. I never wanted to see that look in her eyes again, not ever. Well, that is enough of that, I thought to myself, rolling over in my sleeping bag. I needed to get to sleep. I closed my eyes, began to make peace with my mind, and hoped for a silent night. I soon drifted off. It was deep into the night when I heard a sound and felt a draft. I opened my eyes and saw a shadow move quickly across the wall. It must be Michelle, I thought. She probably got scared downstairs. "Michelle!" I called out. There was no answer. It was quiet in the sanctuary. I closed my eyes again. "Hello, sir!" I heard a voice say. I opened my eyes quickly, but no one was there. I closed them again, thinking I must have been dreaming. Richard, the voice called out again. This time I kept my eyes shut tight. It had to be just a dream. Willow began to stir inside the sleeping bag, and she crawled to the opening. She climbed out and sat right by my side, but she didn't bark. I kept my eyes closed.
We saw what you did for the girl, the voice said. That was good of you.
Will I get in trouble? I asked.
Oh, no, not at all. We will wake her up and get her off to her job in the morning, the voice replied.
It was a powerful voice. It was the voice of a big, strong man.
Who are we? I asked, my eyes still tightly shut.
I'm Horace, the voice replied. I used to be the pastor here, 60 or 70 years ago. I used to give them hell. I used to scare them to heaven.
You're scaring me now, I said. Nothing to be frightened of. I'm here just in spirit.
We've been watching you.
You said, we.
Are there others here?
Oh, yes, there are lots of us. We visit here. Long ago, after spending our days pounding metal at the Navy base, selling real estate, working in the hospitals and the restaurants, we did our best work here. We built a church, fed the poor, comforted the sick, and visited the lonely. It was here we were at our very best.
Have you come to take me? I've prayed for that.
Oh, no, 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 the voice said. You have much to do.
What am I to do? I asked.
It will come to you and you will have much help, the voice replied. In the meantime, somebody is here to talk to you.
There was a moment of utter silence, and then I felt the warmest feeling I had felt in many years. It was the warmth of my mother.
Richard?
Her voice filled me.
Mother?
I was stunned.
Yes, son, the new voice said. I want you to know that I have been with you all during your journey. I was there when you were looking at the photos with Marcia in the hospital, there when you were helping Andy, and there at Lily's. I'm so proud of you. Mother, take me with you.
No, you have things to do first. But I want you to know that I found your sister who was lost, and I am with your other sister and your brother and your father. We have been and we always have been with you. I love you.
And you, Willow the Wonder Dog. I want to thank you for taking such good care of my child. I love you too.
Then the voices stopped. I listened intently in the silence, but I knew they were gone. I didn't need to open my eyes to be certain of that. After a moment, Willow sighed, yawned, and wriggled back into the sleeping bag and settled into sleep. I didn't understand what had just happened, and I doubted I would ever be able to ask anyone to help me figure it out. Were the voices real or imagined? Was I awake or dreaming? Somehow I wasn't worried about that. I had come to trust that not all things need to be understood or explained. It didn't really seem to matter where or how truth came, or how we found the strength to continue sometimes. At this moment, I wasn't even concerned about what I had to do. The voices were gone. But the warmth I felt remained and covered me gently. Chapter 33, the final chapter. So much to write. I awoke in the morning with Willow standing on my chest, licking my face. The sun was shining through a stained glass window. My little dog was doing her utmost to wipe the sleep away from my eyes and clean away the remnants of the tears from the night before. I reached out and patted her on the head.
"Is it time to get moving?" I asked.
I stretched my arms above my head and she jumped off my chest onto the carpet. Now that I was conscious, I was eager to tell C of my nocturnal visitors and see what he thought. I wondered if I had reached a new level of craziness. I quickly rolled up my sleeping bag, stowed it under a pew, and slipped on my shoes. Then I headed out to find C and the armadillo. It was just after 7 when I pulled into the lot of Allen's Minimart. The armadillo was gone. My mind raced with speculations about the fate of my friend. Had the police finally caught up with him and put him in jail? Where were my lynx and calico? The only vestige of their existence was a pile of cat litter near the spot where the armadillo had sat for so long. I didn't know what to do except ask Alan if he knew anything. I expected him to shake his head and grunt like he always did. I picked Willow up and carried her into the store. "Hello, Richard," Alan greeted me, jumping off his stool. "This must be Willow the Wonder Dog. I have heard a lot about her." He reached across the counter and patted her gently. The warm greeting left me at a loss for words. Overcoming my shock, I asked the obvious. "Where did C go?" Alan reached below the counter and held up a stained and wrinkled paper bag. "He left this for you." Alan was smiling as he handed me the bag. I opened it, and inside was a bottle of Dom Perignon champagne. I held it up and looked at the label. It was 1943, the year I was born.
"Very good," said Alan. "Very good year."
"Where is he?" Another obvious question. Alan reached out and hit the round bell. It rang loudly. Then he extended his arms and waved them up and down like a bird in flight.
"You know, see, he's an angel,"
Alan exclaimed and smiled. I was stunned. My mind was in turmoil for a moment, and then I understood. God had, after all, sent me many angels. I had been blessed. Blessed to meet C. Blessed by the lady in red. Blessed to be fed by Mrs. Peebles. To talk to Marcia at the hospital. To share my time with Andy before he died. To look into the eyes of Karen before she took her life at the bridge. I was blessed to experience the Major's mystery pitch and Mary's miraculous hit. Blessed to walk into the woods to visit Adam at the Hilton. To have Rodney share his lucky rocks with me, to be there for Lily's dance for David, to share Sagetti with Dorothea, Elijah, and Dustin. I was blessed to be watched over by the pastor as I slept in the parking lot of one church and to be received as a beloved family member by another pastor whose church had become my home. Many were there to steady me if I began to fall, with a hot meal or a few dollars and a caring glance or a touch of the hand. With kindness, understanding, and love. They treated me with respect, dignity, and grace, while so many others had snickered and scorned. C was my number one angel. He was a slovenly, half-blind, marijuana-smoking, drug-dealing, rum-drinking angel in training. He taught me the joy of rolling in the grass like a kid and helped me see the world through the eyes of others. He got me high by reading the works of the masters and got me flaming drunk on life. C took me to windows where I could view the lives of others and opened up a chapter of the Book of Life, a chapter I had somehow missed. No one could have done it any better, not Joseph Campbell or Carlos Castaneda, not Steinbeck or Hemingway or Mann, not even Buddha or Jesus. He possessed knowledge beyond his years, and he had shared it with me, his fellow traveler. C taught me you have to give half of what you have to help a fellow human being, and sometimes more. When the need is great enough, you must reach even deeper in your pocket and give all that you have to a stranger with no hope of reward. And he taught me that this is the ultimate gift, not only to the receiver, but also to the one who gives. Responding to a need is a leap of faith. Life is a leap of faith, and when you take that leap, you get the ultimate high, which no drug can supply and no amount of money can purchase, an irrepressible feeling that comes welling up from deep inside and causes every nerve to tingle. It makes you cry. It makes you trust that, somehow, somewhere, sometime, the things you need will come to you. It's magic. C had spread a roadmap before me with many paths to choose from. I could go on a bitter journey to a place of anger and hate, or head out on the highway of grace and kindness, though it may be the road less traveled and in greater need of repair. I was going to choose the latter. I had never told C of my journey to the bridge in the year I knew him. I had never learned his last name, or his real first name, for that matter. He never told me. I had never asked. "Thank you," I said, nodding to Alan and putting the gift back in the bag.
"You're a writer, right?"
Alan asked.
"I'm trying to be."
"Well, you have a book to write. You must write now.
I call you Ping Yong.
That means friend." Then Alan bowed to me from the waist, held up two fingers, and said, "Peace. Be safe." I bowed and returned and then walked out of the mini-mart with my bottle of Dom Perignon. After 2 years of wishing and waiting for the angel of death to take me in the night, I now wanted to live. I had a reason and a passion to live. I had learned grace, found a new dignity, a real one, not based on what I owned, and a new identity, one that I loved. I was going to write a book. Mark Twain's final chapter in The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is entitled Nothing More to Write. I, on the other hand, had so much more to write, and that would keep me alive for quite a while. I now had the wisdom of sea, the knowledge of the street, and a new addiction to the drug called unconditional love. I was going to try to finish my book about people without a home. Would my writing open any hearts, minds, or doors so that other men, women, and children would not have to live in the street? Could it give a ray of hope to someone curled up under a blanket in a car or shivering in the cold in the woods? Would it help someone look twice and think twice when passing by a person in need? I did not know. I had never been here before. Epilogue, July 20th, 2005. Be selfish. Volunteer. It was on July 20th, 2002 that I became homeless. I live in an apartment now where Willow the Wonder Dog sits under the table as I write. I was lucky. I'm not sure I would have survived the last few years in Seattle or San Diego or Houston. The community in Bremerton, Washington, helped me out of homelessness. My miracle happened here. Pastor Earl Soule provided everything my soul asked for that day in his office. Shelter in the church for 9 months. Church members to co-sign a rental agreement for an apartment. Others to fix my car when it broke down and to take Willow to the vet when she was sick. Still others to offer me friendship and family and the promise to be there when I die so that I don't have to fear dying alone. And Sandy to first edit this book. More importantly, by his gracious example, he put me in touch with God so that we can have our own conversations now. Willow and I attend church every Sunday where I sing in the choir. Willow sits beside me in the choir loft. She walks at my heels through the communion line, then eats the dropped crumbs of communion bread. In the very act of writing this book, I have undergone healing. In 2003, I was diagnosed with depression-related memory loss. I could not recall the names of my grandchildren, friends or acquaintances throughout the years, streets I had lived on as a child, and many other details about my life. I didn't have a particular motive when I began writing. I just found my friend C very interesting to write about, and as I wrote, I began to remember things and feel things and see things, and I wanted more. So I continued. Perhaps I am beginning to heal on many levels. My daughter, Michelle, called me the other day and invited me to come to her house for Thanksgiving. We had turkey and dressing with all the trimmings, and best of all, I got to spend time with my 11-year-old granddaughter, Sierra, who told me all about her school, her friends, and the softball league she plays in each summer. I gave a copy of my manuscript to Michelle and she read it. She then passed it on to my youngest son, Scott, in Ohio, who also read it. Scott then called me and flew out to buy me dinner one day after Christmas to tell me he loved the book. I had an exquisite salmon and dill sauce with baby red potatoes and received an up-to-date photo of his family, including 10-year-old McKay, 7-year-old Kyler, and 11-month-old Quittery, which Scott tells me means one who is in peace in French. I still see my psychologist, Rodney, every 2 weeks, and he guides me down the river of life. I have learned to embrace my depression. I still go to church dinners and play softball every Thursday on the Salvation Army Field of Dreams during the season. The major is even talking about getting some caps and t-shirts for the games. Alan sold his mini mart and went back to Hong Kong. It's now the newly remodeled Manette Mini Mart and Deli. They even painted the inside of the maple leaf, but it still leans toward the road. I love this town. No, it's not perfect, but then a perfect town doesn't exist. The fact is that there are more people living on the streets in this town and in towns across the country than there have been since the Great Depression. But there are also more people looking at the reality of homelessness and trying to do something about it. In Bremerton, several local churches have fought for and built a homeless shelter to house 20 men and one family. It has taken 3 years to wade through all the permits and construction complications. It seems so small compared to the four-story government center, the new and bigger jail, the convention center and parking facility, the new waterfront condo complex, and the new baseball field. But it is at least a start. Many times, as I prepare to fall asleep with Willow beside me in my bed, I think about the hundreds of times we parked in a church parking lot and crawled into our sleeping bag in the damp and the cold, with no money in our pockets and no hope in our souls. We lived on daily miracles. It was a journey I did not plan, but looking back, I would not change a day, because I met and got to know so many wonderful people, including myself. The homeless lost a dear friend when Mrs. Peebles passed away in February of 2006 at age 74. Despite the repeated warnings from her doctor to slow down and let others do more of the work and the worrying at the Lord's Diner, she kept doing the things she loved and felt called to do. Her son, Michael, took over his mother's calling and, with a group of volunteers, still feeds hundreds of the hungry every Saturday and Sunday. Gentleman Jake can be found at Sally's just about every day. He is now helping the guys coming back from Iraq. Many are homeless and lost. And where is C? He's off someplace, helping some other souls, quoting Joseph Campbell, reading Shakespeare and Yeats from some bar stool, and breaking bread with the poor and hopeless at Sally's in Tulsa, Cincinnati, or Fargo. He's probably got the armadillo parked next to some mini-mart and is reading Hornblower out loud to my Lynx. Maybe he's in your town now. I'm Jeff Hazen. Thank you for sharing Richard Lemieux's remarkable voyage.